Ben Helfgott, Reel 6.
Well, there was very little I could do at this stage because everybody was at work, and I simply had to wait until my father and my uncles would all come back from work. When they came back, I told them, of course, what's happened, and my father then tried to see what he can do to try and get them out. Now, they rounded up 520 people, and they said that they are going to send them away to some other place. Now, but in the meantime, there were certain possibilities to get some people out. In order to get people out, once again, one had to pay huge sums of money. Now, not everybody, even with huge sums of money, one couldn't save oneself, because once again, children could not come out and old people could not come out, and there were amongst this 520 there was a large number of children and a considerable number of older people. When I talk about older people, I am simply talking in terms of the way I looked upon older people. I was 13 at the time. And to me, somebody who was over 40, even younger than that, were older. But I mean, the people when I saw older were people all over 40, between 40 and 50 or something like that. Now, my father, in the end, managed to get permission for my mother to come out. And no matter what he tried to do, there was no way that he could get my 8-year-old sister. So my father wrote, because there was a way to, they were all rounded up and they were all in the synagogue. My father kept on writing to my mother, my mother kept writing to my father, and my father said to her, look, you come out, we will, and I'll try afterwards when I discover where they send the group, I will try and get the baby home. And my mother wrote back to my father and she said, you are out there with two of them, you can look after them, but I must look after the little one, and I cannot come out. Well, the scenes, now I would like to talk a little bit more here about the synagogue, what was going on there. You see, it's very difficult to understand, first of all, the conditions of that place. Now, you'll ask me, how do I know about the conditions of this place? I know it because my mother wrote about them, and so did other people, and others went in there, and others came out who described it. And at one stage, they rounded up, at a certain hour, they rounded up a number, about 30 young boys who were working in the glass factory. And it happened to be one of the shifts that came back from work. I just left, and the following shift that came, they took all the youngsters. And whoever came in at that time from work was immediately incarcerated and sent to the synagogue. But in the glass factory, one of the directors of that glass factory, who was a Volksdeutsch, was a very decent man. And when he heard that these boys were taken away, and especially people came to him to see what he can do to intervene, because most of them worked on his shift. He was in charge of that shift. So he immediately went to the Gestapo and he told them, these boys are doing a very good job, I need them, and he asked for them to be released. And the Gestapo conceded to it, and they were released. Now, of course, when they came out, they told us exactly what was there. The people who were there were living, you see, the place has never been cleaned up. There were no toilets, no facilities to go anywhere. So, and everybody lived on top of one another. So the stench, and there was it was unspeakable in human conditions that they were living under. Now, to make things worse, we only found this out a little bit later, because my mother did not write to us, so didn't write this. But when this one of the boys, who was a very good friend of mine, came out, and he was, it so happens that he was next to my mother's bunk. In fact, he's alive and he lives in Paris today. When he came out, he told me that my mother was, when she was taken to the synagogue, on the way, that dog that I described earlier, what he used to do about the males, when he used to go for males' testicles, that dog went for my mother and he bit her leg, and my mother's leg was in a very bad state. So, and of course there was nothing at this stage, anybody could do about it. Well, this went on for a few days, and then one Saturday morning, the Gestapo went to the synagogue, and they asked for 50 strong, able-bodied men for a specific job that they want them to do, and once they will have completed their job, they would then release them and send them back to the ghetto. Well, they took the 50 men outside the town to the woods, a place called Rakov, about 3-4 kilometers outside the town, and they ordered them to dig pits, 5 large pits. When they finished digging, they were ordered to undress, and at that moment there was amongst them a man who already had a few very narrow escapes, and he realized that this is once again a situation which needed immediate action, and he screamed out, "Let's run!" in Hebrew, "Let's run!" And some followed, and he ran off, and some followed him, because the Germans were taken completely by surprise. By the time they started shooting, a few of them managed to get away. It so happened that they are subsequently caught, some of them, but 3, I think, managed to get back the same evening to the small ghetto, and they told us about what has happened there. Well, I didn't know that evening what happened. I only know what afterward happened. But I know only this, that in the morning, Sunday morning, the 20th of December, 1942, just a few days before Christmas, my father, it was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and my father walked in, and he was crying. Well, I didn't ask him anything. I really knew what fate had befallen upon my mother and my sister. I just fell into his arms, and we both started crying, and we just cried and cried. And there was very little that we could do at this moment. The following day, when my father went out to work, he managed to bribe one of the Polish workers to take, because they used to deliver goods to outside the town, and so my father managed to bribe one of them to take him to that place, to Rakov. And he got there, and he still found, so he found lots of clothing still there, photographs and strewn around, and he saw the place, exactly what happened. Now, he came back in the evening, and he brought with him lots of photographs, which he managed to pick up, belonged to various people. But thing was at least we were now certain what happened. Now, what actually happened was that in the last minute, the order came from Berlin that these people are no longer needed anywhere, and they are at the disposal of the chief of the Gestapo. It is up to him what he wants to do with them. And his decision was to get drunk, have a big party, and then in the morning take these 520 people, take them out. This time, of course, they were very careful about it after what happened the day before. There were a lot more of them, and they marched them out in smaller groups, not to attract any attention to it. And then they took them to the pits, told them to undress, and then they all and they mowed them down. There was a very interesting case where one of the men who was slightly wounded managed to crawl out from underneath all the dead people, and he was naked, and he went to the nearest place just at the edge of the forest. There was a pole, again a folk statue was. Before the war, he used to hunt dogs, stray dogs. That was his job, to get stray dogs and kill the dogs and sell whatever it is. He knew this man very well, so he felt that if he goes into his place, that the man will help him, give him clothing, and will save him. But when he got in there, he was well received by this Volksdeutsch, and then gave him food, told him to go to sleep, and then he went, brought the Gestapo, and took them. The man was taken and shot. Well, that was the end of this story.
How do you know this?
Well, because this was being told by we were told by one of the Germans who by one of the Gestapo. See, it is amazing how much we did know, because the Germans themselves used to tell us. Even those who were killing were telling us stories what somebody else did. There was always a German who was friendly with somebody to tell the story. And somebody else used to tell, and the stories used to come back. And that is how we knew.
Did they show any regret when they tell these stories? What was their
attitude? No, because this became, to them it was a sense of fun. This became a way of life. There was one lieutenant who recognized, a few days later, he recognized this young man who happened to be one of those who ran away from the first group. He recognized him, and he turned around to a Jewish policeman with whom he was friendly, and he says, "You see this fellow there? I know where he was. He was the one. I happened to take a name at him, and then I decided that I will fire in the air rather than shoot him."
When your father visited the site of the killings, did he find anything belonging to your mother or your
no,
sister?
No. He was searching, he was looking for it, but he didn't. He didn't. He found lots of things that he brought back that were other to other people, but that was it.
What was the reaction in the small ghetto that night?
Well, I was just coming to that. Well, the reaction was as if a hurricane hit us, because practically everyone in the ghetto was, well, first of all, we all knew each other. Secondly, there were a lot of relatives and a lot of families that were suddenly again split up, destroyed. And when you think in terms of 520, and there were about 2,400 of us left, so it was one-fifth was suddenly taken away, it was a large proportion. It was devastating. It was like the whole world has come to an end. And for the next few days, we were all walking around like zombies. We just didn't know what was going to happen. But somehow, you see, the Germans did not give us time even to ruminate for a minute, because all the time things were happening. No sooner did this action finish when new action started. They were constantly taking out people and constantly shooting. There were two brothers and who were just coming back from work. They searched one of them. They found on him food, and they made him run. It was the cold winter, and it was the snow was very high, and they made him run. And as he was running, they shot him, and you could see. And he kept running whilst being shot, and the blood was visible all throughout on the white snow. And later on, they didn't remove him. And later on, every time we went out to work, they made sure to show us that this is the fate that is going to befall anyone who will be caught smuggling in food. The next thing they did was. There was a policeman who tried to save his parents. So they took the parents and they took him and they shot him. And they left him for the next 5 days in a very prominent place where most of us were passing by to make sure that we see him. And so this was going on. There was no let up all the time. And there were all kinds of rumors happening, going on, you know, that they're going to send out more, they're going to shoot more. And we simply did not know from one minute to the next what was going to happen to us. So we were living in constant fear, in constant that this is really going to be the end.
Did the Germans celebrate Christmas?
I'm sure, absolutely. And how? They? To them, killing Jews was a matter of joy. To them, this was a way of life. They were rewarded for it. The more Jews they were killing, the more they were rewarded. Now, the fact that they were allowed to go unpunished, it gave them license to kill. Their conscience, there are two consciences, you know, that people have. One is the conscience of that you might be able to, if you do something wrong, that society will catch you, and that society will seek retribution. So people are afraid to do it. But there is also the conscience that one has to live with oneself, what one does. Well, I know that there's one that the conscience of or the social conscience was completely removed from them. The conscience of the personal conscience to live with oneself, that is something that at the time they really didn't give much thought about it, obviously, because if they would, they probably wouldn't have behaved the way they did. So you see, somebody was taking off a light from after we moved into the small ghetto. They were removing all belongings, all valuables from the homes, because people were no longer there, and all this was being sorted out, and a lot of people were working in this place, sorted out, and this was all being sent to Germany. And in one place, they happened to be removing a very interesting lamp, beautiful lamp, must have been a very costly lamp, and. And somebody was either careless or something happened, he dropped the lamp. It so happens that one of the Gestapos was nearby and he saw it. So he took out the gun and he shot him. For any flimsy excuse, people were being killed. Life at that stage simply was not worth anything. In comparison to the other 22,000, the 90% of people of our hometown, we lived with fear, but their lives were immediately taken away, because they, within 1 week, they were finished in the gas chambers. But here we were, dying a slow death. Now, by the time January came, we'd be living in this kind of fear. They then decided that they needed more people to be sent away to another camp. There was a very big factory in Poland, in fact, one of the largest munition factories in Poland, in Skarżysko, called Skarżysko Kamienne, where they employed thousands of people there. And the conditions in that place were such that people were dying off very fast, they're also being killed off very fast, but they needed more workers, so they needed to fill that place, and no sooner have they killed one lot off, they were bringing another lot. So really, those who were killed provided, in a way, an opportunity for others to live. It's very ironical that this is how it was. The death of one group meant the life of another group. Because we were not aware of it. It's simply, this is how it was happening. Now, they caught, this time they were looking for women. There were not many women who left, but nevertheless they wanted some women, and amongst the women who were sent away this time were two of my aunts. And so my aunt had a child of 3 years old at the time. Now at that time she was nearly 4 years old, whom they managed to save. So my aunt was sent away, and my uncle was left with the child. But within a few days, there was something new that happened. They caught a woman who was a runner between the outside and the ghetto, between the ghetto and between other ghettos and between different places. She was a young woman who looked very Polish, but she was denounced by a Pole, and she was caught, taken to the Gestapo, and made to talk. They extracted from her everything that they wanted from her. They reduced her to the point of being a vegetable, but by that stage, she gave away all the names with whom she had any dealings. She was also responsible for bringing in false papers. See, we were also getting false papers so that people could go and be outside the ghetto with false papers. And my aunt, the one who was just been sent to Skarżysko, one of my aunts, she had one of these Polish papers that my uncle made for her through this woman. This woman happened to be a friend of one of my aunts, another aunt, the aunt of whose daughter disappeared so mysteriously a bit earlier. And my aunt sent her to find out what happened to the daughter before that. And so she knew about that episode as well. So she gave the name of my uncle. Now, there were two uncles from my mother's side with the name of Klein. There was my father and his brother, the name of Helfgott. Now, the Germans heard the name Helfgott and they heard the name Klein. But they weren't sure which Helfgott or which Klein, so they picked up all four of them. And they kept them in the Gestapo. Took not only these four, but they picked up at that stage about 50 people for all kinds of reasons that they're connected with this woman. When they interrogated them, they then discovered who it was, who was directly involved. And by some miracle, they released my father and they released my other uncle, Klein. They were the only two people who were released out of these 50. And then they took them out to the Jewish cemetery, and they shot, and as they walked in, they blinded them, and as they walked in at the near to the wall of the cemetery, they killed one after the other.
They blindfolded them.
Blindfolded them and shot them in the back. Again, we heard about it immediately, and we checked it up immediately. They were there. The graves and the names are still there now in that cemetery of the 50 people who were there. So there were two uncles of mine killed. There were some distant relatives there killed. There were my aunt's sister and father, like that's my cousin's grandfather, and a lot of people who were very close to us. So they were killed. I'm trying to tell you the kind of terror that was taking place and how it sort of affected us, because in one way we managed to escape the gas chambers. We managed to save ourselves. And here, step by step, our families were being destroyed in a physical way. So first was my mother, my little sister, then my two uncles, and my cousin, and then two of my aunts were being sent away, and the family was really being reduced very fast.
Was your aunt's 4-year-old child still left in the ghetto?
My aunt?
The aunt who'd been sent away to work in the factory, was her 4-year-old child still?
She was left in the ghetto, yes. But for a few days my uncle looked after her. But now when my uncle was shot, she was left on her own. So we have now taken care of her. That is we, that means my father and I, and my sister. My sister, who was 12 years old. And my sister became really like a mother to her. My sister was looking after her, because at that stage, my sister was not going out to work yet, because we're still living in the small ghetto, and some people in the small ghetto did not go out to work. So my father went out to work, I went out to work. So really, my sister was looking after her, and she was preparing food when we were coming home as well. So she was a little mother at the age of 12. Early in March, the Germans had another game, which they used to play very regularly, because at every Jewish festival they always had an excuse to kill Jews. In the month of March there is a Jewish festival called Purim. It is a story of the salvation of the Jews from Haman. Haman was a minister under the king Ahasuerus, as he was called, and he influenced the king to destroy all the Jews. But Ahasuerus happened to marry a Jewess, and through her uncle Mordechai, she managed to make Ahasuerus see the light, and instead of killing the Jews, Ahasuerus ordered to hang Haman and his 11 sons. Now, what did the Germans do? Now there was Purim. They always used to take out 11 people to kill, and this time was no difference, except that this was going on now more with greater intensity and greater frequency. So they took out a whole family. It was a doctor, a children's doctor, Dr. Brandt,